Radio Tatras International gets on your wavelength. www.rti.fm.
Well, thank you very much, Petra. That was the best counting in I've ever had. I have no idea what this problem with counting in is. Ladies and gentlemen, all I asked to do was count me in. She just got all sulky. So 3, 2, 1.
Go.
Okay. Yes. Right, I've gone. Right, and we're going on to Hooney. I've shrunk the electricity bills.
Oh, yes.
What do we think about that, Mark?
Well, there are. Well, there we are. In the British government, we've got an energy secretary. That's a sort of minister, Chris Hooney, who apparently has decided to get tough with the six biggest energy companies when he was addressing the Liberal Democrat conference in England. He's suddenly announced his detailed plans about how he's going to help people save money by making it easier for people to spot cheaper deals and to switch providers, and he's going to empower the regulator, because there's an electricity or an energy regulator, and he's going to empower the regulator to force companies to give money back for bad behavior and generally control their prices. What a load of nonsense, because of course this is the British government up to its tricks again.
Why is that a load of nonsense?
Well, I'll tell you exactly. Perfect. Well, yeah, doesn't it sound great? Except that we've just suffered an incredible round of price increases from all the energy companies of up to 18%. Now, I mean, wherever you are in the world, you imagine your annual electricity bill, your annual gas bill, and then suddenly you're hit with an 18% rise. Yeah. You know, this is not matched by any rise in income. This is not matched by any rise in employment. This is not matched by anything. It's simply you're suddenly hit for this most basic essential 18%. And what did the government do at the time? Nothing. Okay, nothing, because they don't have the bottle, they don't have the stomach for it. And now, afterwards, when the government's already, of course, starting to think maybe about the next election, when you've got political conferences being addressed, so you've got ministers who are trying to curry favour and try to ingratiate themselves, they now start talking about getting tough. Why didn't they get tough 6 months ago? Who knows? Well, the reason, of course, is it's taxation, because they don't have the bottle, because they don't want to upset things, because that's the way it works. So this is a piece of, cosmetic buttering up of the electorate.
Don't you think that the fact that that people will now be in a position where they can check out deals, and the companies have got to tell people what deals are available to them, even in as much that they will have to tell people, well, actually, if you go to so-and-so, whatever name it is, they are cheaper than us, or they have a better deal that would suit what your needs better than anything we can offer. Is that not a good thing?
I think people's experience generally is that, first of all, there's very little competition between the various companies. Okay, they've got it.
Guys, you all gone quiet.
Am I here?
Well, now you
am
are.
Am I here?
But you weren't.
Well, I thought maybe it's an electricity company that's pulled the plug. But if you had different cables coming into your house, so you could actually switch as it went along, then there would be some real competition, like going into the high street and being able to select from different shops that are competing next to each other. And of course, things like banks, things like electricity companies, gas companies, water companies, they don't compete in this way. And really, it's all nonsense. What there needs to be is proper regulation, but there needs to be proper regulation before 18% price rises and not afterwards. This is a nasty, nasty trick. And basically, it's a lie to the public. Come on, Hooney, you know where I am. Sue me for defamation if you want. It's a lie to the public.
I have a question.
I think that's fine. Yeah, go on,
Petra.
You were going on so long, and I don't know, you put so much into it that who wound you up?
A lot of women say that about me sometimes, actually, Petra, but... Sorry.
Well, listen, I agree. I agree with Mark. I'm sure Mr. Hoon won't sue. But... I just did a bit of adding up before we came on the air. And this is true. This is not an exaggeration. This is the truth of how much it costs you to live in Britain today. If you take, say, £700 as your average mortgage or rent over here, which is about right, £200, say, for your council tax, £280 a month, say, for petrol, and that's only for, like, local journeys. Believe me, petrol is nearly £7 a gallon over here now. Yes. £300, say, for loans, for your student loans, whatever. £400 for food, that's all, and, say, £200 for bills.
You're talking £400 for food in a family for a month?
Yeah, I've kept it low. Do you think it'd be a lot more than that?
Well, I can tell you that I think that from my experience on the Consumer Action Group, there are a lot of families that are surviving on an awful lot less than that. I mean, an awful lot less than that. So,
yeah, but no, wait. Well, they might be, yeah, that's right. But I'm taking it as an average. A lot of people spend a lot more money than that as well, isn't there? You know, it's, if people are not spending, I don't know how much I spend on food. But anyway, but it works out that you need in your hand in Britain every month at least £2,200. That means you've got to have earned at least £3,000 to get by. And like Mark, you've just been saying, everything is going up and up and up. But what's going up is the price of the very basics of staying alive, like power, food, and a place to live.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And certainly, I mean, the people who are worst affected are the people who really are not able to cope with these increases. You know, I mean, I think that it's catastrophic what's happening to a great section of the population. I've no idea, you know, what's happening in other countries. In Texas, for instance, I can imagine that in various cities and maybe outside in the countryside, people are having the same kind of difficulty. It's just a shocking business. And I have to say that I find, you know, this kind of thing from Hoon saying we're now bringing the energy companies under control after they let them get away with it, I find it's really quite callous, actually. It's a piece of nastiness that I find very, very unpleasant.
That is Mr. Gander's opinion of Mr. Hoon. Right.
And the rest of them who do the same thing. Sorry to go on.
Yeah,
but
I understand. I think the views that you're expressing would be sanctioned by a lot of people in Britain today who are finding it very, very difficult to get by. And things like this, like you say, are couched in terms where it looks as if they're there to try and help you. But in fact, they're not. There was a programme on TV yesterday where saying that there was something like 350 separate deals that you were expected to work out for yourself on the internet. You had to do the maths, you had to do the working out of what it meant, you had to do everything. Yeah. And they had a team of people, intelligent people, school teachers, people like that, who sat down and tried to work out the deals. And you know what? I can't remember exactly, but the bulk of them actually got the deal wrong at the end of the day because it was too complicated
to go through. Not surprising. It happens with energy, with mobile phones. I mean, you know, for instance, even in France, and, you know, for me, I suppose the additional problem of a foreign language, but trying to work out all the various deals in banking, trying to work out all the various deals in energy, trying to work out all the various deals and what it means and the on hours and the off hours and this sort of thing, it's a nightmare, and I'm sure it's done deliberately.
I can see where you're coming from. I can understand it. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who feel exactly the same. Let's get on to something else which is controversial too. And people outside Britain will obviously know about the phone hacking scandal in Britain. And it all came about because of Millie Dowler, who was a victim of crime and had her phone hacked. Now, it was this story initially which brought down Rupert Murdoch's News International empire, or damaged it, and ultimately closed the News of the World, which was actually one of the best tabloid investigative newspapers in the world, and will come back in a similar form at some stage soon. But why has Millie Dowler's family been given £2 million by Rupert Murdoch's organisation? What do you think, Mark?
I think it's a public act of contrition by Rupert Murdoch, actually. I'm quite sure that they know how they think it's bad at the moment. I'm sure they know exactly what's going on, and I'm sure they've got a very good idea of how bad it's going to get. And I think that they're starting, if you like, to try and make this act of contrition so that people think, well, at least they've done good by such and such a person. And of course, Millie Dowler's family, you said she was a victim of crime. Just to remind everybody, she was murdered.
Okay. Yeah, she was, yeah.
You know, just a young girl. If people don't know the scandal of this, her mobile phone, which was not discovered, it seemed that News of the World journalists were tapping into her voicemail, hacking into her voicemail, and listening to messages of all the people who were phoning up and saying, "Millie, where are you? I hope we're all right." When the message box got full, the News of the World journalist started deleting the messages to clear it for new messages to be put in. And this caused other people who realized that somebody was clearing the mailbox, caused her family to think that Millie maybe was still alive and that she was actually controlling her own mailbox. Was an excruciating effect. And of course,
I'd like to point out it wasn't journalists who did it. It was private investigators employed by the News of the World. But in principle, again, this is where I, as a tabloid terror, this is where I have a dichotomy of views, and it's nice to hear what other people have to say about it, particularly Mark, because as people know, Mark and I don't always see eye to eye on things, but generally on important issues we do. No, we don't. Listen, Eric's left me in charge. Right, you just behave.
All right, I'll do that.
Right.
And you're quite right. On this, we do agree. It's very important.
We do, actually. Fundamentally, we tend to agree.
Yeah.
But it's my view here is very simple. It's what was done to Millie Dowler. If you think about that, she was the fact that she was a murder victim and the family and the fact that that has on the family. Ultimately, what the News of the World, the private investigator who was working for the News of the World was doing, but I agree with Mark entirely, he did it in a callous, ridiculous and terrible way, was trying to find out where Millie was, just as the police were trying to find out where Millie was. And the effects that had on the family, where were they? Was that as great a pain as the pain of the loss of your daughter? And ultimately, wasn't the News of the World through its private investigators actually trying to find Millie? It's not the fact that they were going to write a story about it. They were going to write a story about it, whether she was found or not.
Well,
and
it's their job. I don't think it was an attempt to find Millie at all.
I think it was
an attempt to get news before anybody else. If they had the details to Millie Dowler's voicemail, then they could have quite easily handed over to the parents or handed over to the police and simply not interfered. This was a disgusting intrusion into somebody's privacy.
The simple fact is that the brief that would have been given by the news desk to the journalists who were working on the Millie Fowler story is the fact it's exactly the same brief as you get about lots of people who are missing, is basically do everything you can to find them. Because that, I'm not saying it's a great moral victory on the side of newspaper sensibility. It isn't. But what a story.
And I'm sure the brief was really get a story out of this, whatever, and make sure you get it before.
That is the brief of a journalist's life. Get a story out.
Well, that's exactly right. Okay. And I think finding, of course, would have been very nice, but it was secondary. But I mean, back to the whole thing about this £3 million offer, £2 million to their family. And why is that done? It's a public act of contrition for publicity purposes. Now, I don't want to say it's callous, because £2 million to anybody is hardly callous, and I'm sure that it will be very appreciated, and it's an important sum, and it's probably does overvalue, if you like, what might have been awarded by a court. But I'm sure that the Murdochs are thinking, they're thinking ahead, they're trying to rescue the situation, and that's what this payment's about.
I'm fairly cynical about the actual making of the payment. Of course, there are plenty of other things that a newspaper organisation could actually do to redress the balance in this case, and just to bang out a few quid, because believe me, his empire and his own personal fortune are not going to be hurt by losing £3 million.
Absolutely. What does it bother them? £3 million? Nothing.
That's right. Yeah, let's move on to the next bit as well involving newspapers, and that's The Guardian were in a position where they were going to be forced to reveal the sources it used for the stories about phone hacking. The courts were actually going to force them to reveal the contacts. The Crown Prosecution Service in England, I'm pleased to say, had decided not to go ahead with it. But why should journalists be forced to sell who their contacts are?
Well, I have to say that I'm pleased as well that the Crown Prosecution Service backed off. In a way, I wouldn't have liked to see the courts in that kind of dilemma and have the courts identified with, if you like, sort of, you know, the breaking of source confidentiality in journalism, because a free journalism and an ethically acting journalism in this country is extremely, extremely important. So why did they back off? I don't know. Maybe they eventually decided. Maybe they eventually decided that actually a free press is such an important thing that they didn't want to get involved. I don't know.
I agree with you. There's an interesting point. Harold Evans, who's probably one of the world's most famous journalists in the world. He's edited the Sunday Times and all sorts of things. And he's now editor at large for Reuters, amazingly. I didn't realise that. But he said he finds it, and I think this is true, and I think this is very, very true, and I think this maybe explains it. He says that it's ironic that Rupert Murdoch's news empire, which has been guilty of the most heinous offences, was actually exposed by The Guardian, and yet it's The Guardian that's now being attacked.
Yes, well, in a way, I mean, that's such a self-evident statement. I'm not sure that it's, you know, sort of massively important thing to say.
Well, it is, because you say that the newspaper, The Guardian, went ahead and exposed what, to most people's ways of thinking, is quite a horrendous thing that's actually affected everybody from the top of politics to the top of newspapers to the top of police. And yet, the newspaper that exposed it is now under attack for doing it.
Yes.
That's what he's saying. I think that's a very important statement.
Well, certainly. I mean, I think it would be rather unjust to decide to try and make the point about attacking sources by attacking The Guardian in these particular circumstances, when in fact we find that, of course, I mean, The Guardian's first interest is getting the story, but at the end of the day, you know, what they've done is to have an extremely moral and desirable result, which maybe might not have happened if their sources had been at risk. So it's absolutely true, I think, to put it in those terms. Unfortunately, they may well be another instance which will come along next year or in 10 years or something or other, where in fact sources are obliged to be revealed by a newspaper in relation to some, you know, incredible immoral and non-ethical scandal, and it's at that point then that we'll find that our freedom of the press is being prejudiced. But let's hope that if that does happen, it will be for a worthy cause. This was not a worthy cause, and what a sacrifice to lose our freedom of the press in respect of an issue where, in fact, if you like, the guilty party, The Guardian, has produced such a public good. That would have been ridiculous, wouldn't it?
It would. What about the Shifty Shake, then?
The Shifty Shake. Do you want to introduce us into that one? Well, in other words, I haven't read that one yet. Yeah.
The Shifty Shake, right? He worked for the News of the World. He was a reporter. He's actually, well, let's expose the Shifty Shake.
Yeah.
Right? Let's name and shame the Shifty Shake.
Let's remove his niqab.
Mazia Mahmoud, right? Mazia Mahmoud. He is the News of the World Shifty Shake. And when the News of the World suffered its demise, he had to go looking for another job. And guess where he's working now? He's working at the Sunday Times. Now, for people who don't know who the Shifty Shake is, Mr. Mazia Mahmoud, right? He's a 48-year-old investigative journalist who actually took his bow with a story about Indian doctors signing off on fake medical reports. Yeah. And he exposed this for what it was. But he also exposed a lot of people, like, and he actually set them up. Like, he would appear at a business meeting or at some prearranged do, dressed as a sheik. He would be expressing his own views as if he was worth lots of money. He was going to do all sorts of things. He worked on whoever his target was as an undercover shake, right? And now he was exposed, and now he's gone undercover at the Sunday Times. Now, does that mean that because of what's gone on, should we not be allowed to use undercover journalists like this, people who went out in disguise and pretend blatantly to be somebody who they aren't?
Well, I don't see anything wrong with that. I think that covert filming and covertly made documentaries are a very healthy thing. And,
yeah, but this bloke's lying to people, out and out lying to them.
Well,
if there is a way of getting story for him, he doesn't care which way he gets it.
And I agree with him, 100%.
Can but I say, I'd like to talk more about that next week.
Yeah, why? Because you've had time to look into it.
Are you undercovered?
Listen, we're running out of time swiftly here. We're going to have to move on. I think we'll have to do this, and then we'll have to go right down to the end of the list.
Right.
And they say, well, what are friends for when you're dead? Do you want me to tell the ladies and the gentlemen what's happened?
Go on.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there's a bloke, right? He's cut the story down so it's sort of basics, but a nice bloke, middle-aged, middle-class, professional bloke, was an estate agent. Unfortunately, he died. But just before he died, he allowed a bloke to move into his house as, like, a house guest, and they got on well. And when his mate came home and found him dead, guess what he did? He took him out for a drink.
Well, that's a pretty decent thing to do. I mean, also, I wouldn't mind that being done for me. Better than burying you down in the ground after,
Then they went out for a meal, and then they took him to a strip club called Shotgun Willie's. This is in Denver, ladies and gentlemen. Shotgun Willie's. They had a dead man sitting there watching the strippers.
Yeah.
I think it's an amazing story. But the lads who did it have got themselves in trouble, haven't they?
Yeah.
Now, I don't know. You can't go around carrying a dead body in the back of your car, can you?
Let's face it. I mean, I think you've got to pay respects. You've got to have respect for the wishes and for the memory of the dead person. Now, supposing it was you, I mean, would you prefer to be bunged in an incinerator?
If you took me to a bar when I was dead, I'd be quite pleased.
Well, there we are. Supposing I took you to a bar in Poprad and Petra and I stood you up in a seat and had drinks around you and drank to your health.
I think that's true. I would love it.
I would even put a pint in your hand to hold it.
Well, no, we'd drink it for you. But I mean, supposing we've
got a bit of rigor mortis, that'd be all right.
We'd have to wait a long time from what I hear. But
it sets it every morning on me. Anyway, shall we move on now to... Shall we do the world's funniest joke or the stupid penguins of the world?
Oh, which do you want to go?
It's your editorial choice now, Mark. You must make this choice now.
Well, I thought that the joke about... in fact, let me start off with a joke.
World's funniest joke. I've got to say this first. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the world's funniest joke as told by Mr. Gander.
Well, of course, I mean, it's all in the telling of it, isn't it? But I mean, in this particular time, this Alsatian dog goes to a telegraph office, takes out a blank form and writes, woof, 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 woof. And the clerk.
Are you sure you haven't been dogging in your previous life?
No, we've been dogging here. The clerk examined the paper and tells the dog very, very politely, excuse me, there are only 9 words here. You can send another for exactly the same price. You can put another woof. And the dog says, well, why would I want to do that? It'll make absolutely no sense at all.
I know I didn't get that, even when I read it and even when you told it.
I hear millions of people in Texas laughing like this. They're all spilling their beer. If you spilled your beer about this, it was a good joke.
I have to say something else. That Mark,
yes,
that wasn't the world's funniest joke. That was the world's second funniest joke.
But it was in the telling, you see, and I made it into the world's funniest joke.
No, Mark, you made a tumbleweed moment. Right, I'm going to do the world's funniest joke, right? And if they don't laugh, ladies and gentlemen, that's only because they're being mean to me, because I wouldn't laugh at his world's second funniest joke, right? Two hunters are out in the wood when one of them collapses. He doesn't seem to be breathing and his eyes are gone glazed, so the other guy whips out his phone and calls the emergency services. And he says, "Me friend's dead! Me friend's dead! What can I do?" The operator says, "Calm down, I can help. First, let's make sure he's dead." There's a silence, then there's a shot, and he comes back on the phone and says, "Right, I've done that. What do we do next?"
No.
Well,
funny joke. That's a funny joke. Anyway, yeah, that's the world's funniest joke, ladies and gentlemen. It really raised a titter off Petra. And, Germany, Mark.
Yes.
You're not going to like this. What is the country with the world's second best sense of humour?
Well, I see here on the list that it could even be France.
I know. I think that's funny.
There's not even the French word for fun.
Isn't there?
No.
And what do they use?
Eh? Well, they simply say, they say it's amusant. In other words, oh, it amused me. I don't quite see that's fun, actually. Do you know what I mean?
Because they can't have fun, then.
No, they can't. They can be amused sometimes.
Here's the world's fourth funniest joke, right? Patient goes into the doctor, says, "Doctor, I've got a strawberry up my bum." They said, "Don't worry about it, we'll give you some cream for that."
I didn't like the joke. I like how you said it. I'm amused.
Amused? You've been amused. What's a really funny joke in Slovakia?
No, tell us a Slovak joke. I can't tell
jokes. We have to say it in Slovakian, that's the trouble.
Yeah, tell us a Slovak joke in Slovak.
Oh, yeah, as everybody would understand it.
What about the Mile Low Club for Mark? We have to do this really quick, Mark, but we're... this is about, ladies and gentlemen, Mark chose this story. It is very good.
Well, I mean, last week we had this incredible story of a passenger jet being forced to land because two people, in fact, turned out three people had locked themselves in the lavatory for various purposes. We imagine
like a bluting.
Oh, yeah, of course, a bluting. That's right. Yes, a bluting, all three of them together. Fantastic. We decided they probably would join the Mile High Club. Well, this week I see that there's a story about some very, very deep sea squid that lives in waters that are so dark it can't even see who it's trying to associate with. And apparently it ends up having mating activity.
Connubials. Ladies and gentlemen, any of those words you can use.
It starts mating, and sometimes it mates with squids of the same sex because it's too dark to be able to tell the difference. It's quite a side life, really, isn't it?
That's a bit of a surprise, isn't it? It's basically like...
It was a bit of a surprise for them. They said, "Oh, bloody, it's a bit of a surprise for me. I'm sorry, I thought you were a girl."
Well, that's right, yeah.
Sorry, I thought you were a girl.
Well, Phil used to be a film about. No, can't do that one. Carry on, yeah. No, I agree. Well, let's finish off now because we're nearly there.
There were two squids on a corner, and one of them says to the other, look at over there. There's a nice pair of legs.
Anyway. I thought you were going to do the six squid joke. Where's that six squid, Yomi? Anyway, so we're moving on to finish off on poor old Happy Feet again. I make no excuses. I make no excuses for bringing up poor old Happy Feet because I've realised since then that it is penguins that are just stupid. We've got one round the corner from us here in Staffordshire, in the Midlands, in the UK Midlands, yeah, that's frightened of water. It won't go for a swim. People are coming from all over the world to see it because it won't go in water. And then we've got another one. I'm trying to do something and my machine won't work.
Maybe it just doesn't like the temperature.
What, in the water?
Yes, maybe it's perfectly happy, but it would just like to be, you know, in the Caribbean.
Or maybe he can't swim. Or it can't swim.
Maybe it's like you said, the very first time he used it, he should wear Wellingtons and he could just go for a paddle.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, and then we've got another one that's been dumped because he's gone bald. He's a penguin, already gone bald. His parents have disowned him. That's in Dalian in China.
Well, he should use the drops for the hair growth.
And then a randy seal has been caught on camera trying to have sex with a penguin, trying to do ladies and gentlemen's with a penguin. Anyway, the penguin didn't do much about it at all, and it took 45 minutes for the seal to get fed up and give up. And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. There we have postcard from Poprad once again. And it's been lovely. Say goodbye, Mark.
Oh, goodbye.
Say goodbye, Petra.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye, everybody.
This is RTI, from the heart of Europe to the world, the station of the stars.